Everybody, unbelievably, it's already 5:30, and most of us are assembled. Yes. So we will go ahead and begin the Champaign County Mental Health Board meeting with a call to order or roll call by Stephanie, if you would, please, Stephanie.
Tom Moore.
Here.
Judy O'Connor.
Here.
Joe Omolosagie.
Here.
Elaine Plincia.
Here.
Kyle Patterson.
Here.
Julian Rappaport.
Here.
Ann Robin. Margaret White.
Here.
Susan Fowler.
Here.
We have time for public participation, citizen input. If there are any individuals who would like to participate, we ask that you keep your comments to 5 minutes, and we can spend about 20 minutes total, no more than that, in public participation today, given the size of the agenda, but you're welcome to come forward. Welcome, Anne. Okay, seeing no citizen input or public participation, we'll move on to additions to the agenda. Do we have any additions to the agenda? Okay, moving on, Developmental Disabilities Board information. Judy and I were at the DD board meeting this morning. I think they broke a record in terms of how quickly they started and stopped, but they didn't have a lot of business. However, they did ask Dale Morrissey, who was on his way to Springfield, to report back to them on how things went with the IARF, in terms of the priorities for pushing the legislature. Do you want to come up briefly and fill us in?
Good evening, Dale Moore, CDSC. Thank you. Actually, I missed part of the committee meeting because I had to be here for the DDB meeting. So, but overwhelmingly, of course, the highest priority has been the budget and, as importantly, or if not more importantly, the staff shortage issue, as we've talked to you about for months. But that got actually overwhelmed a little bit today because of the ACA. Everybody, the whole discussion there was the significant potential negative impact that's going to have if passed as proposed on individuals with disabilities, all disability populations, and then, of course, the elderly. And as Lynn and I were sharing this morning, because Illinois is already so far behind in our rate system, we'll get disproportionately hurt worse than other states. And so, and as I shared, I'm also a little bit concerned because it will give, and I'm not saying this is a political statement, but it'll give our governor the excuse to say, well, if all the states are this way, then we don't, they're all this way, so why should we do anything about the wage issue? Because it's like we're all bad, which we all know the state of Illinois is so much worse, and the staff shortage is so much worse because of the wage issue. So anyway, overwhelmingly, there was no discussion on a grand deal right now. There was the two bills, one's in the House and the other's in the Senate. The Senate's further along on the wage issue, and I think the discussion there was that will probably get passed at least out of the Senate to put more pressure back on the governor again. I think the real key thing on the wage issue was that the governor promised, or in his statement, his veto statement, which was really unusual. When he did his veto statement, he usually doesn't make a written, but he did say, hey, as a part of a balanced budget, I think this is a high priority and should be included. Well, when he made his budget address, he said he had a balanced budget, but that wage wasn't in there. So we did sort of put that back in his face saying, hey, you said as a balanced budget that you're going to include this, and if it's truly balanced, then that should be done. But I think it really goes back to, again, the grand deal. So no more than that, except that things have not moved forward any further. But the good news is 18 months ago, we weren't on the radar screen. But I think individuals with disabilities, at least in the state of Illinois, we're on the radar screen. We are in the discussions with other populations, with the universities and things, which we weren't before. And so I think that we've made some progress. So hopefully as the grand deal is cut, that maybe something will happen. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Dale. I know that everybody's concerned about the current status of the budget, and there's no way not to be concerned. But we appreciate all the advocacy that's going on in the community for mental health, developmental disabilities, substance abuse, and other special populations. So next item is approval of the Mental Health Board minutes, which are on pages 3 to 6. And I'll open up by asking if there's anyone who would like to move to approve, and if there are additions or changes, we can have discussion. Okay, Elaine moved to approve, and seconded by both Margaret and Tom. Any conversation, comments, discussion? Hearing none, I ask for a vote of approval. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Not in favor? Okay. I am going to defer my comments first to allow Lynn, to our executive director, to make some comments. I might make some of the same comments if I don't wait first. So please go ahead, Lynn.
Oh, okay. Well, just as this morning the focus of my comments was on errors that I made in the board packet, I need to just to get these into the record, and then maybe just another comment. But first of all, there's a typo on page 44 in the booklet. I think I let everybody know about this, but I want to make sure it's in the record. The typo is a result of my excitement about the presenter and the data. I wrote that the national healthcare cost in 2017 would be 3.5 million, but it's trillion. So that's a. See, that was a really important error, and I apologize for that. I also, you know, I was also excited about the content, because the point is long-term supports and services, which are primarily the service of people with disabilities and the elderly, are 55% of Medicaid costs on behalf of 5% of the population. So that number, 3.5 trillion, is a whole lot our business. So, and there's, as Dale said, there's some very dire predictions about what would happen to Illinois if we went to the block grant per capita cap, and it's related to that. But anyway, there were other issues, really exciting issues from that presentation, and so I wrote down million and trillion, and I'm very sorry for that. Related to that memo, you should have copies of these. These are policy briefs, and they also have the committee membership attached to them. If you do want to reach out to legislators about any of these issues, you'll notice it includes one on public health, and our fate is really tied to public health. The 21st Century Cures Act was passed at the end of last year. It was very good news for behavioral health. It preserves SAMHSA. Now there needs to be an appropriation with it. But the prediction was also that it would take money from public health. So we do need to protect public health prevention and promotion efforts. And so the briefs here include things that may not be like purely behavioral health on the surface, but I think they're important. So I brought them to you, and these were developed by our national associations. So the other error in the board packet is in a really complicated report on eligibility of persons with developmental disabilities. And the error is simply that there's a category which at the very bottom of page 46 shows an unduplicated number of 97 people, and that's correct. In the paragraph above it, it doesn't appear to describe more than 97 people, but it's just because I didn't put one of the numbers in bold. So it's 64 plus 4 plus 10 plus 15 plus 10, and then there's another 10 that should have been in bold. Is that right? 64, 3, 10, 14, and then there's another 10. But so the happy news is the duplicated count is 101, so that's really nice. That's only 4 people who are receiving services at more than one agency, and I thought that was really good news.
97 versus 101.
Yeah. So anyway, those are my errors. I just need to get them in the record. I do also want to ask you about interest in a study session event for the afternoon of May 5th, which is a Friday at 1 o'clock. There's a gentleman coming to the country from Canada who's an innovator in DD, particularly in person-centered planning models. He's a really interesting presenter, and he's coming anyway. So, and this room is available and tentatively booked if you want to from at 1 o'clock, probably 1 to 3, and then we might... Dave Wetherow. He's the innovator of microboards and cooperatives and some of the other, the related concepts. It's nice stuff. So, anyway. I think that's it.
It was of particular interest to the DD board members, and I've been to a training where he spoke through video link, and it was excellent. So, just something to add to your calendar if you have the flexibility. I think person-centered planning is likely to also be pretty prevalent in behavioral health issues because the philosophy is the same. If you want the person to be motivated to change, it has to be person-centered planning. Oh, sure, go ahead. No, it's fine.
Oh, and this is something I just forgot about. I can't share it with you because it has the names of individuals receiving services. But at a board member's request, I got an update on our SILAs, the two SILAs that we own, and we have an agreement with a provider agency to serve people. And it's a really nice update, but it's very personal. It's just talking about three people who live in one of the group homes are doing really well. That home opened in September of 2016. September of 2016. I think that's a mistake. I think it's September of 2015. So then the other home opened in May of 2016. That's the newer one. They started with three women, and then they have added a fourth person. So there are three men in the first home and four women in the second home. And everybody seems to be doing all right. But anyway, they produced that report overnight, which was nice. And I can't share it with you, sorry. But
it's good to know that things are going well at the SILA since it took a while to staff the second one. In terms of issues for the agenda, I'd like to just take a moment and offer the board's personal condolences to two of the staff members who've lost family members in the last week, Chandra Somerville and Stephanie, both of whom had fathers pass away. We share our concerns and sympathies with you. I also would like to note that the office has been very busy with the organizational assessment, and there will be updates on that, as well as on the revised job descriptions that have been developed for each of the positions on the Mental Health DD board.
I've actually already shared all of that.
And you've already shared all of that. And that we're in the process of conducting, we being the royal we, staff and Lynn and representatives from the board are in the process of conducting interviews for an associate director for developmental disabilities and the financial operations person. In terms of our agenda, we only have one action item today, which is a little unusual, which may allow us some time to talk a little bit about the review process towards the end of the meeting. It's not a formal addition to the agenda. It's just that if time allows, I've been doing some brainstorming on how to organize thoughts. And if you're interested, I can share it. If you're not, I can withhold it. But since we're doing this new system of primary reader, secondary reader for the proposals, with each of us reading approximately 10, and the fact that our next meeting, April 26th, mm-hmm. will be when we begin the discussion. If we don't have a study session between now and then, it might be good to have some guidance between now and then. And the only date that's available for a study session is March 29th, mm-hmm. Which is next week, which is possible if the board would so desire, but we'd need to post it. Otherwise, the study sessions will be after the first discussion in April 26th. We have study sessions in early May to continue discussion of the proposals. So at this point, we have 40 proposals for the Mental Health Board to review. You've each gotten distribution of who's the first reader and the second reader. And hopefully you've gone to the website to see if you can log in. If you waited like I did until last night to log in, I had to wait until I could talk to Lynn to retrieve my my login, which I had forgotten since last year. And then I had to wait until I could talk with Judy to make sure that I was doing the right steps once I got into the actual website, because I was missing a couple of steps and getting stuck. So intuitively, I'm sure it's easier than what I am describing, but just know that if you haven't gone in to look yet, you might want to, and then feel free to call Judy for navigating or staff for logins and navigating. And I will note that we don't have the program summaries that staff and consultants are doing, which are the 2 to 4 page summaries that we usually get in April and read in order to make our determinations. What we have at this point are the full proposals. And so if you're interested in reading the full proposal before you get the summary proposal, that's why you might want to see if you can log in. And we'll talk about more of that towards the end of the meeting and some suggestions I have based on reading two sets of proposals.
But by tomorrow, they can look at the drafts of the program summaries.
Oh, that's great. So tomorrow there will be drafts of the program summaries?
Well, they're not.
Fabulous.
They're very, very rough drafts. These are the things that is what Mark and I have been working on. So they're very, very far from complete. We're going to start really rocking pretty soon.
Great. Great. Well, the more information, the better. All right. And so we're not editing those drafts. We're just reading them only. And they'll continue to work on the drafts. Make sense? Okay. Staff reports are deferred. They're available within the packet. And we do have consultant reports on.
It's in the packet.
It's in the packet. Do we have Dr. Allen and Aber here?
Nicole was going to come, but
I think Nicole had to stay home with sick children. Okay. So we have the written report.
So we could take a moment if there are questions about the written report on the evaluation capacity building that we have. It's only a 4-page report or a 3-page report. It's pretty short, 4 pages, pages 7 to 11, prepared by the 2 U of I staff members and some of their associates who have been working with 4 agencies to help them build evaluation capacity. And those agencies are Promise Healthcare, Family Services, Senior Counseling and Advocacy Services, Community Choices specific to the CONNECT program, and Rosecrans specific to case management provided in the county jail. If you recall, we had lots of discussion last summer about how difficult it was to evaluate proposals because there are not clear and consistent outcome data. And so Julian and Tom worked with consultants to, is that fair to say, to help initiate an evaluation process. Actually, that started probably more than a year ago. And this is an interim report on their progress, which notes that it is difficult to identify similar outcomes across agencies, but within agencies and programs, they are making headway, helping them build a logic model and identify outcomes. I don't know if Tom or Julian would like to add to the report. I know we would at some point like to have them come in and talk with us, probably this summer.
They'll do a year-end
report. When they do a year-end report.
They're going in and evaluating whether the program is good.
They're helping the program.
What they're doing is helping the program people develop their own ability to evaluate what they are doing. So it's a collaborative venture between us and them, which I think is a pretty good philosophy for us to have. So.
Just a clarifying comment. The Community Choices Program, they're referring to it as Connect. And if you're looking in your portfolio of investments, you won't find that. This is within Self-Determination Support, which is a contract you've funded for several years. It's just, it's one of the things that they do under Self-Determination Support.
Any other comments on the evaluation capacity building? Okay, then we'll move on to board-to-board reports. I know that we shared assignments last month for members of the board to serve as liaisons with other agencies. We have more agencies than we have board members, but I believe a couple of board members were able to go and meet with other agencies. Anything that you would like to share? Judy?
I was assigned the liaison for Crisis Nursery, and I went to their first board meeting and felt very welcome by everybody who was there. They were so organized. They had all of the information that I needed. I went a day early, and they toured me through the building, and I felt very comfortable there. And then I had volunteered to go to Prairie Center, and I met with Gail Rainey, which was, I had toured Prairie Center before, so I was familiar with it. But sitting down and speaking with her and one of her staff members, they are just so down to earth about serving the people. And both agencies, which was really impressive to me, is they reach out into the county for their programs, and they have the data to back it up, and I'm really proud of, I feel really, really good about that. So I hope it'll be a good match.
Tom and then Joe. Joseph? I'm a liaison for First Followers. And I see them regularly in an informal way. I haven't been to a board meeting, but just stopping by there. If anyone is ever interested in finding out what they do, you just stop by there at a Bethel AME Church. And they're there on Tuesdays and Thursdays, like from 1 to 5, and either Marlon or James are always there. And there's a good chance that you can see some of the gentlemen that they work with, and you get to see how they operate, see what kind of space they have, which needs to be updated, but that's neither here nor there. But you see what they do with people, the actual work that they're doing, and they have an incredible vision and plan for where they want to take this first followers and how they're going about documenting what they're doing and how they're educating the community. They've made several educational outreaches to the community where they presented themselves. And I think on April 17th, they're having an open house. So if I get that information, I'll let you know about it. But this is a pretty powerful project, and we should be proud to have, to be funding these guys.
And it's one of the first year, it's in its first year of funding.
So I went to Rosecrans, and since Rosecrans has taken over the mental health center or community elements, it's just, and having worked when it was a mental health center, seeing the changes that are occurring, Rosecrans is very much into drug and alcohol rehab, and so they have a strong focus on that. They will also be starting a day program for adolescents, which would be, they would have 3 days a week. So there are several different things that Rosecrans is going to try within the community and over the years, because a lot of the focus has been drug and alcohol. Mental health is established, But now the drug and alcohol part of it will become part of the bigger umbrella that Rosecrans would work with. And really, a lot of times, those two work hand in hand. I mean, can have mental health issues and also drug and alcohol issues at the same time.
I went, as usual, to the DSC board meeting, and we'll be going again tomorrow. This report would be kind of like last month's report, the challenges of reallocating resources to meet the challenges of funding and changes in the whole field of DD. I think the board, the meetings are always very organized. The board has a very useful mix of skills on it, the people who serve on the board. So I always learn something from that. And then in addition, Judy and I went to the last meeting of the Community Coalition, and we were thanked for funding something we weren't sure of. but you know, as mental health board members, so that was interesting. But I think that was... I think it's crucial, we both thought, for us to show up there on a fairly regular basis and hear what's going on. It was very useful.
Rosecrans is also thinking about kind of buying a house on campus to have as kind of a clean house for students to live in, almost like a fraternity sorority where they can live, and it's a clean house where students who are going through recovery can live there without having the pressure of working through the potholes of college.
Jillian.
So I usually try to go to the meeting of the crisis intervention team, which is police officers from the various jurisdictions and many mental health service providers. They meet at Rosecrans, so it's kind of a convenient place for the mental health providers and to show up. And the police pretty regularly show up, and there's a nice interagency and police conversation that goes on. A couple of positive things to me look promising. They've been working for some time, the police have, on figuring out how to better and more carefully report what happens when they send out a CIT officer, and when they see somebody, and you know, and what follows and where they do it, and so to sort of kind of nail down a little more of the details of those interventions in a systematic way. The other thing that I think it looked to me like Carl might be getting more interested in having their emergency physician and other people involved in crisis management, maybe even, you know, in an effort to try to reduce the numbers that go on at the emergency room. They're actually contemplating, I don't think they've done it yet, but it sounded like they're serious about having EMT people engaged in that. So that was a sort of promising development. There seems to be a general, I would notice over the time since we started paying attention to this, there's a general cultural awareness in our community about the importance of those kinds of crisis intervention activities. So I think that's a pretty positive community development.
Margaret.
I met with Chad Hoffman, who's the new executive director of MACI, the Muhammad Era Youth Club. They're on track to serve over 500 kids in their BLAST and their MACI Matters programs this year. They reviewed their cultural competency plan at the board meeting. And in addition, they're in the process of they're trying to change their location. So they have to work with the city, and they found another location that better suits them. And then they also have in their building and when they move this, this is part of it. They house the high school 18 to 22-year-old program. So basically, they use it all year during the school year, and mm-hmm. It's a neat relationship. So thank you.
Great. I do want to encourage people to feel free to go to Community Coalition and other meetings if you have interests, questions. Certainly feel free to contact staff for times, locations, because staff are often involved in many of these meetings. I think it's great that folks are making initial contacts with organizations for which they're serving as liaisons, and that we've had some changeover. I also want to note that last week I had the opportunity, along with Sheila Ferguson and Rick Snyder, to talk with the Champaign County League of Women Voters about what the issues are in mental health and public health facing our community, and the tough decisions that this board will be making in the next couple of months. So appreciated being able to do that as well. Okay. Moving on then from board to board reports, we have time for agency information. If we have some agencies that would like to give us a 5-minute report, that would be terrific. Sheila? Okay.
Good evening. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Monica Cherry, and I am the supervisor of the Access, Crisis, and Respite departments at Rosecrans. And I just wanted to take a few minutes to talk to you all a little bit about those departments, to just give you guys some information and some data of what we're experiencing in each of these departments. So our Access department is where I'll start, and this is our department where we screen individuals according to their behavioral health needs and talk with them, collect information in order to provide them linkage to the services that they need, whether that is psychiatric services, counseling, case management, substance abuse services, whatever those needs are, and then providing linkage for those services. In our first 6 months of this current fiscal year, we fielded 993 calls through our Access phone line to provide information and linkage to services within our agency and within the community. And then we also conducted 417 face-to-face intake screenings at the agency. Moving on to our respite department. Our respite center is a small 7-bed facility that is used for the purpose of short-term psychiatric stabilization. For those of you who know where the Time Center is located, it is attached onto that same building, but a separate unit. We have a psychiatrist who comes every morning to meet with the clients to address any psychotropic medication needs. We run up to 4 groups a day with clients and then do individual meetings with the clients to kind of look holistically at the issues that they're facing and do case management services with them while they're there. And the hope is to stabilize their psychiatric symptoms and provide them ongoing treatment when they leave with outpatient resources. We did see an increase in our average length of stay. According to the data, we've seen it increase by about a day. So we are seeing kind of that trend to more of a need there. The last department that I'll talk about is our crisis department. And on our crisis team, we have 7 clinicians. Their education levels range either bachelor's level or master's level, and it's in a social service field. In our department, we are contracted with both Carl and Presence here in town. So anytime somebody shows up in one of the emergency departments or really anywhere in the hospital, we are the team that is called out to conduct a crisis assessment. To determine level of risk and then needs for services and then facilitate those dispositions. We also can see people at the office and do fairly frequently. And the crisis clinicians also help to answer the 24-hour crisis line, and we field a good deal of calls through that. In our first 6 months of our fiscal year, we assessed 796 individuals in a state of crisis, and those are all face-to-face contacts that we had made within those first 6 months. The third part of that particular department is working with local law enforcement, and that's really been the piece that we've been working to grow, working with all local jurisdictions, because what we are seeing is that there is an increase in the length of stay for clients for individuals in crisis in our emergency departments. This is due to an increase in acuity. We've definitely seen an increase in acuity of symptoms, and then it just has become more difficult to place people in inpatient psychiatric settings, particularly at our state hospital level for those individuals who need that longer length of stay. And so working with local law enforcement has become very critical to reach out to those people who have those higher acuity or have a lot of law enforcement involvement to hopefully get ahead of that and get them involved in services, get them engaged, and hopefully reduce the number of people going to the emergency department. So that's been a really key part of the crisis department for a while. And so on that note, I will turn it over to Brian Tyson.
Good evening. Let me apologize for my voice. Going from 70 degrees to 20 degrees does not make my sinuses do well. My name is Brian Tyson. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a police officer with the University of Illinois. I've been there for just about 21 years. I came from the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department, where I was a road deputy for 5 years. I run and coordinate our crisis intervention team at the U of I. I also sit on the county crisis intervention team that Dr. Rappaport mentioned earlier, and we have seen our numbers increase so much in law enforcement contact. Just to kind of dovetail off of what Dr. Rappaport said, what he was referring to, we have two departments who religiously, for the least of the last few years, have kept track of their CIT contacts. That is the University of Illinois and the Urbana Police Department. So we have pretty solid numbers from those departments. It's not that we don't have buy-in from the other departments, but it is a long and arduous process to do police statistics. We now have, in effect, that went into effect March 14th, in our report writing system countywide, our CIT tracking forms and our CIT information forms. April 1st, those go, and it was just approved. The system is working, surprisingly, for a new computer system. And April 1st, that will go mandatory. In other words, every police officer that uses the ARMS system in the county, which at the very least are the Rantoul Police Department, Urbana, Champaign City, Champaign County, and U of I, will mandatorily have to answer whether there were CIT issues on their contact, whether or not that person was transported, what symptoms they were showing. Did we call Rosecrans? Did we call Monica? Did we have the crisis team come out? Was it done by phone? Was it done in person? It's a very detailed and data collection that we've done just two departments for the past 5 or 6 years, but now we'll involve the whole county. We're already seeing our numbers start to come in, and it's not even really official yet. We've added mandatory boxes to increase our data, such as, is the person do any military benefits so we can hook them up with the VA? Are they University of Illinois affiliated, not just a student, but affiliated with the U of I, which means those will automatically be pulled and given to the correct U of I departments, either the counseling center, faculty, staff services, the police department, DRES, anybody like that that needs it. Also, mandatory check boxes are they identified either by us or self-identified as homeless so we can hook them up with the correct services, see you at home. All the symptoms that they show so we can track it, we can track our excited delirium, all of that is coming in. We will get a full 3/4 of a year of data using the new system. Our stats for 2016 are not quite done. I almost have my departments compiled, but they have to put with the other ones. So just to give you an idea, the University of Illinois Police Department, 65 sworn officers, which in the mid to high 30s are at a street level. We're looking right now at our CIT contacts for 2016, right around 300 CIT contacts. The majority of them are U of I and student population, but certainly not all of them. We deal with the general public on a daily basis, either assisting the other police departments or in the areas that are near campus but are technically not campus. Of those 300 contacts, we had right now, and I think it's going to be a little higher when I'm done, but I know for sure 97 transports to the hospital for petitions, so basically attempted suicides or close enough to that that we felt they were a danger to themselves or somebody else. We did have a really big spike in 2015. We're kind of looking to see if the stats are going to go from August 18th, 2015 to December 31st, 2015. We had 187 transports to the hospital for attempted suicide and 7 completed student suicides. And that's just the student population. That's not anyone else. Being able to work with Rosecrans and have the CIT bringing this together, I do a lot of training. I am one of the CIT trainers for Crisis Intervention Team for the state of Illinois. I get to travel a lot across the state and across the country to see that we are the exception to the rule in this county. You do not see police and social services interacting and talking. It is done very well here. It is getting much better. One of the things that's come out of our meetings, and Dr. Rappaport talked a bit about it, is although we don't have the system in place yet to solve a lot of our problems, our problems get solved by the people in the system, not the system itself. You very seldom go places where at 7 o'clock at night when neither people are working, you have people talking on the phone about somebody that needs to be put in the hospital, which just happened last weekend with a student that was released prematurely from Carl. Monica and I had a conversation 15 minutes after it happened. Within 48 hours, he was back at Presence and admitted because of his risk factors. So this is not an exception to the rule. It is the rule in this county of police and social services working together and being able to utilize the individual strengths that we have. There are things that social services can do that I cannot. There's a lot of things that I can do in my job title that social services cannot. And we've seen putting those things together has become extremely important as to what we're doing and what's going on. So hopefully by this time next year, we will have hard data for just how much is going on. I think that people that aren't touching this are going to be extremely surprised at the numbers that come in of what we're doing.
Thank you. Any questions from the board or comments? Julian.
I just want to thank you for coming and talking to the board. What I want to do is verify the fact that there's an amazing conversation going on between the human service community and the police community in this county. I think it's got more to grow yet, but it's really happening. And so it's quite remarkable.
I'd like to just add that, you know, two of the priorities for the Mental Health Board are systems of care for youth with serious emotional disturbance and their families who have multi-system involvement. We're certainly seeing cooperative police and social service response to those crisis situations. As a parent, I was in one of those a few years ago, and thank God there was a crisis team because I didn't know what to do. And then one of our other four priorities, so two of the four, is to provide behavioral health supports for adults with justice system involvement. And we are hearing from board reports and from agency reports that the investment the Mental Health Board has made has perhaps helped leverage the agencies in moving forward. We can't really take credit for that, but we hope that our efforts to prioritize those elements are part of the success of what's going on in our community.
And just to respond a little bit to that, and I won't take too much more of your time, because of these issues that have come up that are happening here and in other places, I am in the process of training all 420 armed parole agents with the Illinois Department of Corrections in mental health intervention and de-escalation. It's an 8-hour, not the 40-hour. We're working on that one, but it is an 8-hour class. They've had zero training in the past. So I've got half of them done. I'll be done in the end of June. So it is it is reaching out farther than just local. It is going on the state level. With the statewide CIT initiative, there's a 40-hour CIT class going on in this state 50 out of 52 weeks of this fiscal year. So, and we have gotten private funding for some of those classes, one of them here in Champaign that was funded by the Stevie J Broadcasting System, and his fundraiser that he did funded a privately funded, which it's an expensive class. One of our three, so we'll have three classes this year instead of two.
So, as a counselor at Parkland, I've gone through the training, and I think it's really beneficial to any practitioner, law enforcement, or counseling to be a part of it.
We are regularly now having in our CIT classes law enforcement, county corrections, state police, as well as emergency dispatchers. And we're looking now at EMTs and first responders as well.
So part of what you just, we had a long talk at the airport as I was on my way to the conference. And one of the things you just described is part of, that's part of what the state has to do in the Rasho versus Baldwin class action lawsuit. So with your information then, for the next couple days, that was one of the, justice and behavioral health was one of the big topics of each conference. And I happened to start looking for information about the court monitor and the semi-annual report that's required with that, and I couldn't find anything. So my colleagues thought maybe there is no court monitor yet, and maybe no report has been filed. I thought maybe you would know.
I don't. I can certainly find out. The training that I'm specifically doing, so the training that was mandated by the Rasho decision, which was a lengthy lawsuit on how DOC houses their inmates with mental illness. They are retraining, or training in most cases for the first time, 24,000 correctional officers in a two-day training that's been put together by NAMI. The parole agent part of it was specifically pulled out, honestly, because they're such a small group of employees, they were overlooked. And just by chance, some of their administrators were at the Crisis Negotiators Conference last year listening to us talk, and it was completely accidental that the training got, and they identified we've left these people out. That's how it was started. So I'm sorry. I'm the vice president for the executive board for the Illinois Crisis Negotiators Association. I run the Metro SWAT for Champaign County. I run the hostage negotiation team as well as a negotiator. So that's how it was. It was serendipity. I don't know. Really, it's just everything. Everybody happened to be in the right place at the right time. I will see them actually here coming up. I will see if I can get a report or at least get an answer up to where it is.
Even if you can find out if there is an appointed court monitor at this point, I mean, it's still pretty early in the implementation plan. So if there's a court monitor, just having the name would be great, and then I can start looking in the usual places for the report.
The psychiatrist that's in charge of all the training is on the board with me, so I can get you an answer pretty quickly.
Thanks so much. We know you're losing your voice, and we really appreciate
I'm trying to talk quietly, so I don't have to
the time you've taken. Again, we really appreciate the agency report. Are there any other agency-to-agency reports? Okay, please come forward, and we'll try and keep this to 5 minutes. Obviously, this report had a lot of details and complexity.
Hi, my name is Adelaide Amy, and I'm the new Executive Director of Rape Advocacy Counseling and Education Services, and I wanted to give you a brief update. First, we wanted to say thank you for the support over many years and decades that the board has given to our agency. And some of you may remember that last June 1st, the agency, due to the state budget impasse, had to almost close. It reduced services down to just a skeleton, just the hotline. Since then, and there was a part-time staffer coordinating the hotline that was funded by an emergency grant from United Way, for which we're very thankful. Since then, our very committed board of directors has worked diligently to get the agency back going. They hired me in January, and we are committed to restoring full services and to designing an agency which is stable without state funding. So we're going to try to do it with just federal and local and private, because we're the kind of agency people don't like to think about us until someone they know and love needs us. And we are there 24/7 on the hotline with our advocates who go to the ER and meet the victims there. We also do counseling. I've hired a new counselor who'll be starting May 1st. And right now we're doing a search for an advocate who goes with victims through the court system or other things that come up due to being the victim of a sexual assault. So we just wanted to say,
you've been able to resurrect the agency into more of a full-time, into a full-time initiative. We know how difficult it was last June, and are just delighted that the board and staff were able to pull together and start again. Julian?
Does anybody else do what you do?
No.
That's been my impression, that you're the only game in town, right?
Well, it's designed that way, to not have duplication of services.
We have a statewide organization, and they only charter one in each geographic area, and the federal money comes through them, so it would be tough to do it, but you know, you don't really want different hotline numbers to call. And
yeah, well, I was just thinking it's really tough to do it if you're not able to function because you don't have any resources. So
right.
Thank you for
what is the geographic area, Champaign-Urbana or Champaign County?
We do actually, we cover four counties, so Champaign County. I hope I get this right. Ford, Piatt, and Douglas County. But because those counties are so rural, have such low population, the vast majority of the people we interact with are from Champaign County.
Okay. Thank you.
And we do, of course, not only do we do CU in the rural areas, but Rantoul also.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Seeing none, we appreciate very much the information that was shared today, and we will move on to the financial information, pages 12 to 18. A copy of the claims report is provided on those pages. I'll ask if there are any questions from the board regarding the expenditure approval list, and then we'll take a voice vote to approve or not approve. I assume that everyone has had some time to look over the budget. Tom?
I move that we accept the financial information as it's presented.
By Margaret White, thank you. All those in, any comment? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much. Okay, new business. I believe that Mark is not available today, but Lynn, would you like to talk about the FY 2016 Annual Report, pages 19 to 39.
Boy, would I.
So in the past, I've been responsible for two reports in here, and then this year I got to add a couple, the financial reports, and I spent almost 24 hours looking for $100. I would spend that much time looking for one penny, because when it's money, if you're off a penny, then there's at least one problem. So it was rewarding because I found it. It was, yes. But I was also really pleased to see what it was. It was in the olden days. We used to have retirement gifts for board members when they were leaving, and Dolores Henry chose to have a donation made to the food bank instead of a gift. So I thought, wow, I love this board. So that was the $100 difference, and it didn't show up in the auditor reports of contributions and grants, but when I went to their 500-page report of every payment, I found it. So that's my story about the annual report. Otherwise, as you remember last year, there were errors that we hadn't identified. So I think it's perfect, but it really might not be. I tried to fix the formulas that create the demographic pies last year, and I checked them this year, but something else could be going wrong. I did have some questions from one board member about what some of the categories mean. So if you want to talk about any of that, I can tell you.
So that's the nature of my questions about this is intended for the public to be able to look at, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's not just an internal report.
Right.
So I was a little bit wondering if we could maybe make some of those categories' meanings a little bit clearer. So, like, for example, I don't think it requires a lot of work to do this. The service totals for the contract year, that graph,
mm-hmm.
It's not 100% obvious.
Page 28.
Thank you. Page 28. It's not 100% obvious to me whether those numbers represent contacts or clients or hours or all of those things or when it's which. Could that be made just...
Well, how would you elucidate it?
Pardon?
How would you make that clearer?
Well, I don't know. I mean, by saying it is what
I
would
think. I don't understand what's not clear about it, but that was the question that someone else asked. So.
Well, okay. So there's, on this chart, there's numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know whether that's a number of people or the number of contacts.
It's different per category. Each column represents a different category.
No, I understand that it's different per category, but even so, within category, it's not obvious to me without some sort of footnoting of it that it refers to hours or clients or number of contacts. And then hours appears in some of these, but not others, so I didn't understand.
They're only in the fee-for-service contracts will there be a note about what the unit is. So the first column is CSEs, and it's described above as a community service event, which is not, so that's a count of events.
I understand that one.
Then the next column is service contacts, which is described as encounters for various purposes.
So does that number mean number of people?
No.
Or number of contacts?
Number of contacts. Some agencies will further define that as they will only count. They will only report one contact per person, so then it's that's an identical measure to people, but some use it to describe various contacts.
So all I'm suggesting here is expanding the definitional things with little footnotes or something
per
that make
agency?
Those things clear.
Do you mean per agency? Because there's a key at the top describing what the categories mean.
Yeah, maybe I do mean per agency. I mean, some way to just conveniently know
mm-hmm.
what's being referred to. At least I don't read it easily.
Okay. So.
I don't think it's.
So we could, we do that in program summaries at the, you know, before things are funded, and we can capture that language and plug it in here if that makes it helpful. That's one of the things that we identify, is exactly what the agency plans to report on in each of these categories. So we could do that.
Well, maybe this is completely transparent to everybody else, and it's just I can't read. But it's not transparent to me.
I'm just...
Okay. Margaret?
So, Julian, I would agree with you on part of it, because you may have a client contact, say you do a health fair and you see 400 people, so it comes out as a very high number. Or you may have client contact and it's the same client 30 times versus how many clients actually served. That's what I was thinking when I looked at it, too.
Yeah, you have to pause and try to figure it out.
Yeah, how many clients are actually served by the agency?
Well, that information's in here.
Yeah. The TPCs and the NTPCs are numbers of people served.
Right. Yeah, I think... Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Anne.
Be recognized. I had trouble with this, too. And it's not to be critical, it's just to say we need more clarification. So TPC I'm getting is unduplicated clients, is that right? Yes. So you could just say unduplicated clients. Because I'm kind of inferring that, but I'm not sure. And
also they're not just unduplicated clients, but they have a treatment plan.
They're people who have a treatment plan and have had an assessment.
Right, okay. But that's unduplicated individuals. Right. So there's, let's say, 138 individuals who have treatment plans under the early childhood mental health. Right? Okay. So I can understand that. But just because it's numbers and letters, it's hard for even me, whom, you know, educated but old, to kind of parse this out. So a little bit more discussion as to what all of these things mean.
So narrative format is better than a summary?
No, the summary is great. You just need more information at the top of the page.
Well, the agencies define each category according to the type of service that they're providing. So it will result in a narrative per program, which is fine, but we already have provided that in other documents, so we can float that in here. So we just don't use the chart or use the chart and then add several pages.
Describe
it. If I can suggest that this is a conversation that probably would best be conducted in a small group. I know we can't have more than two members of the board meeting with staff, or it becomes an open meeting. But I also agree that I didn't know when I looked at this report how it compared with the previous year's report. It took me a while to figure out what the different categories were. And then I knew that because agencies count things different way, I couldn't, for instance, compare community choices with developmental services center. And if I did, the numbers are really different.
We can't solve that.
We're not trying to solve that, but I think a narrative that would say do not do cross comparisons, or that would actually refer people back to the website where you have the program descriptions.
Do you all know how to get to the website and look at that? It's on the public page of the website. It's really early on the...
It's actually where you would go if you wanted to read the proposals, too.
But you don't have to log in to read it.
Oh. Tom.
Lynn, what do you hope to do with this page? What do you think it's supposed to do?
Well, this is the format that's been used for 20 years. So you can compare from year to year. You can compare if you're interested in numbers of persons served. But the contracts themselves change every year. So, and the amount of money invested in each program changes every year. So it's possible that this report is absolutely useless. And I would prefer not to spend days creating this report if it doesn't make sense. I know that it's not comparable from year to year because of the nature of the programs, and it actually duplicates information that's already presented to you in a narrative format in different places.
Because what you might have
places.
Maybe these are never clean categories, and so they're always, it'll always be complicated because you can't say for sure these are duplicated, unduplicated, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It may be that these categories are too complicated, and if there is another way to provide the same, if you think you're providing the same kind of information somewhere else, maybe you don't want to do this. I don't know.
Before we go back to Julian, is there anybody else that hasn't made a comment that would like to? Okay, Julian?
So maybe I misunderstood the point of this. I thought this was intended for as an annual report to the public, not necessarily as a report to the mental health board. So it doesn't, it would be nice if whatever it's trying to convey mm-hmm. was understandable to someone who would, of normal intelligence, who would pick it up and look at it and be able to kind of get what it's saying. I think what it needs is just annotation. I think it's okay to report this stuff, but, you know, with footnotes perhaps, or, you know, annotating each category. And if it has to be different for each program, well, then just an addition of annotations.
Okay.
So it's not that I think it's useless. I think it's just too much work for people to figure it out. And so it won't serve its purpose if it's not more obvious.
So what I'd like to suggest is that board members send to Lynn recommendations, not for this year, but for next year's report, because now she's in the midst, along with other staff, with trying to do the program summaries. We've seen this report every year. Every year it's been a bit confusing, and I think we're sharp enough now, finally, for us to acknowledge that we don't really know what it means, which is great. We've come a long way as a board. But rather than spend more time on these two pages, if we could go on and discuss the other parts of the report. Elaine, I did not mean to cut you off if you wanted to say something.
No, I think it's a, somebody was, or Lynn said, is it useless? But I think a lot of questions have arisen about service contracts over, contacts over the years, and misunderstandings, like, what did they do with their money? They only have so many service contacts, you know, that kind of thing. So I think the information is very important to have. It's how not to, not so much, from my perspective, not so much how to understand it as how not to misunderstand it. And that's very important for both the public and other agencies to have some way of understanding, because this gets right to the heart of how the money was spent, how many people were helped, and they're not equal. As we've said before in these meetings, the help is not equal. The need for help is not equal across the board of clients. So that's why it's so tricky.
It also doesn't take into account interagency collaboration and meetings across entities.
It
attempts to.
Sure, that's what community service events and service contacts sometimes include. Those activities, well, especially community service events.
So it seems like what would be useful is to have descriptions of the services provided by each program, descriptions of how each category is defined by each program, and then the chart. So it will no longer look like a chart. It'll be a few paragraphs with a, you know, with the line of the final results. But that might be a lot more useful and a lot more readable. So,
can I make a suggestion? If you are going to do that, why don't you just do it with a couple of these things and not do the whole thing all over again, and see how it looks and whether or not that's what people want. But before you spend a whole bunch of time trying to rework it, just do a couple of them, see if it works out.
Yeah, because based on working in some of his agencies and getting some of his monies over the years, everybody provides service differently. And you look at Operation Snowball, for instance. We had retreats, 3-day and 4-day retreats. How do you put that on paper as contact hours? So for each agency, yes, it might be advisable to do something, small write-up about what kind of contacts they are, what kind of assessments were done, what. But that would take a lot of time, and I don't. Yeah, I know, and I don't know to what extent we want to do that.
I would recommend to follow up with Joseph and with Tom that it not be a priority right now, because we're moving into making decisions on funding, but that individuals send Lynn their thoughts and recommendations, and that when Lynn begins to work on this a year from now, 6 months from now, we'll have some background information that will be in her file that could be useful.
And then I just want to suggest that you even look at the applications, because it's really outlined in the applications. We've also given you on that front page what we funded, what the services actually are. So I think it's just kind of cross-referencing. And so if we need to combine all of that, then that may be possible. But I think that it's what you're asking for is already there. So I think it's just a matter of just continuing to use it as cross-reference.
Okay, so let's move on, because we will be spending more time than we really have on trying to improve the report rather than review the report. Are there other comments about the report or other things that you wanted to note, Lynn?
I think it's in a footnote. This was another, I felt that it was important to explain why the total of contributions and grants is higher in one report than it is in the other. And the reason for that is that when agencies return excess revenue that they didn't spend in a contract year, if they don't do it right away at the beginning of the year, if they wait till after the independent audit and then we request the excess revenue, then it's too late for us to deposit it back into the correct category in the previous year. So it just goes back into the fund balance. And that's the case here. We had one agency return every penny of the money. And they returned all of it, and we were not able to deposit that until after the auditor was finished with 2016. So it just goes into fund balance. It's still important for you to know how much was obligated and during that contract year, because that's how we figure out what we can do next, right? Anyway, so it's being deposited into fund balance at this point.
I have one question, and again, it's not to be necessarily addressed today or in a revision, but I would find it helpful in understanding the revenue and expenditures page to just have a short narrative on the fact that property taxes in August and June fund much of the activities of the Mental Health Board. And then that for the administration of the Mental Health and DD Board, X percentage is involved in administration and X percentage is involved in grants that are given out.
I'll speak to that real briefly.
Okay, that would be great. And you can infer it from the first page, but I think just a nice, concise statement would be helpful for the population.
So our deposits, the big deposits of tax dollars occur in June and August. And so we have we reach our lowest fund balance in April. So one of the strategies are in order to obligate as much money as possible to contracts with agencies, we budget for more than we can actually afford to do at that low point. So the agencies don't get a payment in May. They get a double payment in June in order for us to be paying out on the second gigantic deposit of the year. Last year, additional TIF money was deposited in like November or something. It was additional for you. The DD board did not have that great good fortune because at the same time, the county discovered an error in their spreadsheet in the calculation of the levy, and the DD board had less money than it was expected to. So the TIF deposit only offset that a little. Administrative costs, as presented, include some professional services that are actually related to programs. They're pretty substantial. If you make the adjustment for those, the biggest one is the PLL supervision. That's $150,000 a year. And then there's another one, the one for the U of I program evaluation contract, that's $55,000. So if you just pull those off, our administrative costs are, in 2015, they were below 10%, which is below the industry standard. We're currently operating at 5 or 6%, which is actually considered dangerous and that we will be ineffective at that rate. So we need to repair ourselves by adding back some administrative costs. You don't see it in 2016. That was a fat year. We don't have audited expenditures yet to be able to say what our percentage was compared to the investment and contributions and grants. For 2017, we will be at about 5 or 6%, and that's not okay. So we're going to try now to build ourselves back up. But anyway.
Other comments about the report? Section 2 is the 3-year plan with 1-year objectives, which we obviously are using to review our proposals. Tom?
Yeah, I have two comments.
That's part of the annual report. It's
that's not part of the annual report.
It is,
exactly.
It is, yeah.
And it's already approved, but it's already approved. Yeah. I'm just noting that it's there.
I just want to hear Lynn talk about this graph on page 31, the allocation by target populations. And this is just a question I'm asking. I have nothing to base it on. I'm just curious, when we have committed to a target population, children and youth, like 10%, do you think that's enough?
But look at the seniors,
it's like 5%. Well, I'll come to that later. I mean, I have that in mind. But I don't know if this children and youth is somehow mixed up with the family stuff. Maybe some of it gets taken. But seniors have had their day. So the youth, if you think, I don't know for sure, if you think that we need to maybe explore that or something. It seems low in just my thinking. I have no reason to say that. I don't have anything to base on. Just seems low.
How does that compare to the facing page, which divided up by the circle, divided up by age? I'm having. So if you look at numbers of people, the youth are quite a bit larger representation than 10%.
What you've got sitting in that is the Head Start DD program. So whenever one of the early intervention type programs comes over to the mental health board's DD roster, it blows it up with, but they're low cost interventions. They tend to be screenings or brief therapy or referral services. So because those supports are very inexpensive per person, that's a big number there, but then a small number on the cost side.
So I was just trying to relate to Tom's question, which on the one hand, it looks like, oh, we don't do much with youth because look at such a small percentage of them. Maybe that's true. But over here, well, we have school age kids 17 and 16 if they're in school, age 7 through 18. Yeah, that sounds pretty high to me. So
I think Prairie Center's youth prevention program touches a lot of kids, and that's countywide too. So that has some good residency data.
So I know this is difficult to discuss, and maybe I think part of the problem we're having is the purpose of this report is frankly muddled. Is this a report for us, or is it a report for the public? If it's a report for public, as our annual report, it's really important that it not be misleading, that it be really clear. And if we have to use words to make it clear, we should do so. But I'm worried that if this is an annual report that we're handing out, you get a lot of misunderstanding if it's not clear. So all I'm asking for in general is it be clear. And while I was going to hold this at Susan's request, but since we're talking about these pages now, you maybe could just use, instead of on the page on the right-hand side, the funding by sector, maybe we could use words instead of those abbreviations. They're not immediately intuitively obvious to everyone, so I don't think it would be much difficulty to just use words. But again, that's assuming that what this is for is not just for us, but for other people. So I know this is a nuisance. I'm sorry about that.
I think that we have begun to look more carefully at the reports over the years. I remember 4 years ago when I came on the board, it was indecipherable. Now it matters that it's decipherable. So I know that this is something that we are being asked to approve. I think that I would like to go back to recommending that everyone provide recommendations to Lynn via email so that she has a file, and that if there are some things that are very obvious that can be corrected without an investment of more than 5 or 6 hours of work, that occur. Again, just thinking of the fact that we are down to 4 staff.
We're down to sometimes 1.
Sometimes 1. And we're in the middle of preparing summaries for all of the contracts that are coming in. Would that be a reasonable approach for Lynn and staff to take? Wait for comments from us and then go back in and make minor amendments for clarification and then improve upon this for the next year?
I think that if, in fact, we do want to make some adjustments to it, that that's the best way to do it. It's not fair to have Lynn go back in the dark and figure it out and then,
right.
No, that's not what I meant. So
right.
If we can't help her with it,
right.
Then don't ask her to do it.
Right.
But there's also, I don't think that we're burning to have this approved, right? We have time.
We don't have time for the applications. To review the applications is so important, and to get really confident recommendations for funding by the end of May, that's really that is the timeline that drives everything else. This is an annual report. We can keep working on it.
Right. I don't want you to have to imagine what the changes need
okay.
to be.
Yeah, and we'll just don't work on it until we're done with the allocations.
We're somewhere in there.
Let me call on speakers just so that we can keep going. It's almost 7 o'clock. Tom?
I just have a comment.
Final comment.
That's not for Ms. Canfield at all. It's for the board in general. It's on page 38 under the three-year plan. We're treating all this as one, right? Mm-hmm. So.
And this actually was approved in December.
Okay. On that community engagement and advocacy, after our last board meeting, particularly as it relates to stigma and what the movie that we support, I started thinking and doing some reading about the stigma, and I came away thinking that we don't pay enough attention to stigma, not that we should pay less, we should pay more. And one of the reasons I'm thinking about that is because this whole notion of stigma is not only related to what I might think of mental health or behavioral health needs, but it also has to do with people who need services. And because of the stigma that's attached to these, they frequently don't seek services. And so I think that we need a stronger education program. And so this is for the board, not for, this is for the board to think about beefing up what we're calling anti-stigma, so, and really incorporate it in the kind of, work that we do. Because I think it turns out it's far more important than I think what we're paying attention to with regards to how services are delivered, who gets them, what the general public thinks about them. And so I just want to make a plea for us to think more broadly about this and more intensively about this.
Okay. Any final comments about the 2016 annual report? We've agreed that we will send comments to Lynn so that she has guidance before she would move to make changes or corrections, and that there is no need to approve it today.
Or April.
We can table it for a little while, which puts the pressure on us as board members to send comments proactively to Lynn and staff so that when they have time to go back and elucidate more clearly, they will have our guidance in that elucidation.
Do you have a motion on the table?
No, we don't have a motion on the table. We had just begun. I'd asked you to talk about it. We hadn't started an action.
So we could have a discussion after we move, after you have the motion.
Do we need to have, we could table this rather than have an action and defeat the action. And
I move to table approval of the annual report until after the allocation season is completed.
Seconded by Margaret. Okay. Comment? All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Okay. Thank you very much, Anne. We are an active board. I can say that. With lots of opinions. Which is good. Can you provide a very brief summary of the policy conference, or is the briefing memorandum and the handouts, are they sufficient?
Well, there's...
I think the briefing memorandum is sufficient, but there's one thing of follow-up. I think somewhere in here I noted that I had asked them to consider bringing us back into the decarceration initiative, which we had gotten dropped out of for a reason I understand, but it was not my choice to have us stop working on it. It was something that happened that was very practical. So I sort of begged, can we be let back in? And they said, we'll consider it. And then I also said, also, would you consider us as a pilot community for some federal support for the work that we are trying to do here in collaboration with law enforcement? And they said, we'll consider it. So the good news is yes to both. I've had that answer since then. So we're back in.
Does anyone have questions about the IDDD eligibility? This was a memo or agency feedback that Lynn put together in response to questions that came up primarily at the Developmental Disabilities Board, where there was an effort to try and determine how much duplication of services.
Not duplication.
Duplication of individuals?
Not duplication.
Okay.
That's just a side effect of the survey.
Side effect of the survey. Okay. To find out who met eligibility requirements. And if they didn't meet eligibility requirements, would they, if they were screened, meet eligibility requirements?
I was really pleased with the results that the agencies provided. So just because what happened is that our funding guidelines set a bar that agencies couldn't meet until July of 2015, and then now we have a person in the community who does this, who helps establish the eligibility that we need to see, but she can't, it's just one person. So she's taking on the cases as quickly as she can, and I think we'll ask for an update on this in a few months and see where they're at, but I was very pleased with how far along things are. We're sort of getting an understanding of who needs to be deemed eligible, or if there are lots of people who don't meet the state's eligibility criteria, then we need to talk about our criteria, and if there's a service gap that we want to fill by redefining our criteria.
So. Yeah, I guess my concern when I read this partly comes out of being the parent of a developmentally disabled adult. There's so many criteria and barriers and hoops that people have to jump through, and you could look at someone such as my son and go, that's a developmentally disabled person, but unless the appropriate professionals had filled out the appropriate forms and put them into the appropriate computer programs, my concern would be that he would lose his services. And so, you know, as an advocate for developmentally disabled people, it always makes me nervous when I see a list of, well, this one isn't eligible and that one isn't eligible, and I'm thinking about the kind of, what can I say, politicians who are in control of our country right now who would go, well, cut that program because all of those people are not eligible. I don't want to make ourselves vulnerable by this made me nervous to see this. Now, maybe I didn't read it correctly, and maybe this is showing tremendous progress, but what I wanted to see was a little discussion about how, okay, these people are being served. They're appropriate to be served. We know they're appropriate to be served. How do we prove that to funding agencies, and what is our process that we're going through to prove that, and what kind of progress are we doing? When I see a list of, you know, there's six people here and seven people there and two people there, I'm thinking somebody's going to come through and cut these things. So we don't want to make ourselves vulnerable to that. That was my only concern.
Well, I would suggest you have control over the funds. You and the DD board have control over the funds. And these people may very well be eligible, but they have not been seen by the person here at the Independent Service Coordination Unit who will say, yes, that person meets the state's eligibility criteria. So that's our current rule. If our rule is not working, then we need to look at our rule. I don't think we can tell from this if the rule is working because people haven't had enough time to get everybody in front of her to get that eligibility. So the other piece of it is this is important because the state is compelled to make awards, permanent funding awards to people who are qualified. They're compelled by the Ligas class action suit, and if people are not enrolled in PUNS, which is the mechanism that serves this too, they won't get that award, and they also won't be seen by the state as people who need anything because local tax dollars are taking care of the needs. So
exactly, that's my concern.
So, but that would be the reason to wait, not change your guidelines at this time, but I think that's what's been in the back of my mind is, our funding guidelines might be the barrier that we need to look at. But anyway.
I believe this all came up because there were a number of people who were grandfathered, and there was an effort to try and determine if everybody who was receiving services was eligible, and the Independent Service Coordination Unit does reevaluate for PUNS. If you're drawn for PUNS, you're reevaluated to see if you're eligible for PUNS. that's almost like double jeopardy.
Right, well, it's sort of...
But I recognize the concern of laying out the fact that there could be X number of people receiving services who may not actually have met the diagnostic criteria. And I think that what this is saying is that there's an effort to ensure that everyone does meet the diagnostic criteria.
No, I got that.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Anne. Okay, so we have our meeting schedule with our next meeting being April 26th. This is different from the originally scheduled April 19th. We changed the schedule because of Ebertfest activities that take place on April 19th. And coincidentally, I was going to be out of town. So we will also be, I'll be back in town on April 26th, and there won't be an Ebertfest, and that's when we'll have our initial discussion of all the program summaries and the 40 proposals for review under the Mental Health Board. If I could take a minute of your time, I started reading a couple of the primary review proposals that I that were designated to me when we distributed the 40 across the group of nine. And every year when I've read these proposals, I've always tried to figure out some way to summarize information so that I could hold on to it, to basically chop it into clumps that were manageable. There's technical terms for that within the cognitive field. But my clumping was to, and I'll pass these out. This is a suggestion. Certainly, it's only a suggestion, but I took the priorities of the Mental Health Board, and there are four priorities. I took then from, and this all comes from our report, there are also then overarching priorities. I think we have to look at our language at some point in the future. And then there are secondary decision support criteria. And so I listed, and they're not necessarily all equivalent in weight, but I wanted to know, A, did it meet one of the four priorities of the Mental Health Board, because that seems to be absolutely essential, particularly if money is tight. And then I looked at whether or not it was meeting most of the other priorities, secondary and overarching. And so here's an example, and again, this isn't perfect, but I took two organizations that I was assigned, and I deleted their names. You could probably figure it out. And I just took those factors and made a matrix so that it would help me remember what I was looking at and be able to talk across eventually 10 proposals or 9 proposals. This may be my idiosyncrasy for how I again chunk or clump information. But if it's helpful to anyone else, please feel free to use it. I just know that because we have not only the four priorities, but then we also have multiple objectives under each of the, we also have 10 goals in the strategic plan, that it can become a little bit overwhelming when you look at the variables for making decisions on funding. I also noted whether or not it was a new request or a continuing request, and then provided space for comments. In doing this, I was able to go through two proposals this afternoon in about 3 hours and at least have some sense. Of course, I also highlighted and noted things that were of particular interest that I didn't translate into the matrix or the table. So I'm giving you some unsolicited advice, which you can ignore, or you can take, if you would like, for just as you begin the process of tackling those 9 or 10 proposals as a primary or secondary reviewer, here's one potential strategy. And we can share strategies at a study group meeting if we need to in May, if people come up with some some other or better ideas, that would be great as well. Yes, Julian.
Thank you for your suggestions. Because you're a lot more obsessive than I am.
Oh, I don't know.
And I'm sure that will help. But I have one question that just, I wanted to see if maybe you can help me with this. When I went into the website and was looking at stuff, am I correct that once I get into a program, it looked to me like what I have to do, and this is what I did, is I have to read each section separately and then get out of it and go to the other section. And
yep.
I was really found that to be unbelievably cumbersome.
Can I respond?
Sure.
I spent Christmas vacation designing the program summary template online so that you could go to one place and find all of that. Tomorrow you'll have access to those. It's all it pulls from each of the sections, automatically derives the sections of interest, the narratives, and just puts them in there. And then there's space for comments, which there's some of the comments are already there. They will not be in that form when we create public, you know, draft versions, but they're still, they'll be cleaned up, summarized. Everything, like all information is there right now. And now the job is to edit and summarize from
that.
Yeah,
all I was asking about is, I think, and this
but that's why I designed it, because it's a hassle to go in and out of the forms.
But we still have to go in and out of the form to read it ourselves, right?
Sure.
I understand we'll have your summaries, but if I'm not mistaken, we do have to go in and out of each section.
Well, you can read complete sections on the program summaries online, because they're just copied there so that they're kind of all in one place. But not all of this, like the budgets are separate, so we still have to go back to each budget form separately. But yeah, that's how it works. It's... You have to go in and out of every
section.
Maybe
we'll discuss this for the future, because it seems to me that it's got to be there's got to be a simpler way to
we could go
be
back
able to
paper.
Read it all.
That's how it was.
No. That's
I mean,
not
that
what I'm suggesting. Never mind.
No, it worked really
I have to
well.
Leave, so I don't want to have the conversation. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't doing something, making it more complicated than it needed to be.
We will have paper copies of the program summaries, as we did last April. The two-volume book.
I hope they're more summarized than that. But
I think I was not here when this process was developed, so I'm not quite clear on what we're doing anyhow. So I'd like to know what it is we're...
Could I have a conversation with you after the board meeting, just to expedite the process?
Yeah.
You may have been gone during part of that discussion.
Yeah. I think you were.
Yeah. Okay. It is at that point in the agenda where...
Do you want the study session next week?
We decide if we want a study session next week or not. Comments, thoughts? It would be an opportunity for members of the board to get together and talk about their initial review of their assigned programs and if they were having any concerns, issues, or difficulties. Otherwise, we wait until the meeting in April, and then we have the opportunity for some subsequent study sessions. Seeing an enthusiastic jump of individuals to say, yes, let's have a study session, I propose that we vote to adjourn this meeting, and our next meeting will be April 26th.
We have an announcement.
And then before we can do that, however, Liz has just told me that she has an announcement. Right. Go.
It's become very difficult to keep track of all the things that are going on and to report them to everybody who might want to know. Ebertfest will happen before we meet again, so you should know. It starts April 19th. It goes through the 23rd, which is a Sunday. Our featured film, I asked for permission to share it with you tonight. She said, no, wait till tomorrow morning, so that's too late for you. But it will be shown on Saturday morning, the 22nd. Our panel discussion will be an extended Q&A on the stage in the theater after the film. That'll be around noon on Saturday, the 22nd. The art show, that's sort of a tradition out front of the festival, will be Saturday, the 22nd from 9 to 5. We're still trying to work out a youth showing of the film because it's appropriate for youth. It's about a young female athlete who has bipolar disorder and a substance use disorder, and she will be here, and the director of the film will be here. It's less than an hour long. It's perfect for a high school screening, but we're really having a hard time. Spring break makes it really hard to coordinate with the schools to get something together, but happily, it seems that they might be able to hit the midnight basketball events, which are, they're at 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock every Friday, so we might have some events on Friday the 21st as well, and that will be the director and the film and the star going to do some motivational talk with middle schoolers at 8 and high schoolers at 9 at their basketball games.
I'll be happy to make a motion to adjourn, but I also want to make a comment that I really appreciate the meeting, the back of the of our packet that includes the meeting schedules, and I think I said this last time, the acronyms. I hope that list grows. That's very, very important to have. Yeah, and the more that can happen. So again, if you have comments about the acronyms, pass them on to Lynn so she can get them into our. List. With that, I make a motion that we adjourn the meeting.
Second.